I see the world your way, and I'm not afraid to follow. I see the world your way, and I'm not ashamed to say so. I see the Jesus way, and I'm walking in the light.
Well, welcome to Walking in Faith, God's Blessings. I'm Barbara Schinkel. Thanks for joining us today. Just recently back from the March for Life in Washington, D.C. It was quite crowded there. First time ever a U.S. president has addressed the crowd at the March for Life, as you all are very much aware. And quite frankly, never before have I seen so many people at the march. This was like off the charts crowded this year. And today's show, we're going to bring you some of the flavor of that march. The march this year really focused in on a theme, and it was really kind of taking the critics right to the heart of the matter. It was pro-life is pro-women. So often we hear these arguments about how pro-lifers don't care about the mom, they only care about the baby, which couldn't be more untrue. But also this idea that somehow if you're a woke woman, you would never be a pro-life advocate. Because, of course, women have to have unfettered ability to do anything they want with their body at any time, which is the message of the modern feminist movement. But I want to bring you a talk today from a very interesting legal scholar. Her name is Erica Biancochi, and she spoke at a series of speaker events prior to the actual March for Life. This wasn't on the stage with thousands of people. This was a really interesting discussion that happened in an intimate setting prior to the March for Life. And she is coming out with a book on the actual beginnings of the feminist movement in our country, Seneca Falls, Alice Paul. And she has a wonderful take on what the women's movement really saw as the rights for women. I think you'll find it really interesting because what she was saying, basically, I'll boil it down, but I want to give you the entire talk and we'll present that in the show today, is that women were very aware that for society to be lifted up and for women not to be taken advantage of and for men not to be able to exert power over women, that they had to become more virtuous. Not that women had to become more like men in terms of preying on the weak. That men had to really kind of step up to the game. And this was the call of the early feminist movement. I think it's really, really interesting because I've never heard that angle before. And I think you're going to find in this talk that when women become exactly what they disliked in men, which is preying on the powerless and the weak, they end up becoming sort of a paradoxical image of everything they hated with men at the beginning of their own movement. So in other words, their whole thought and process wasn't that to empower a woman, you had to have the unfettered access to abortion because you're preying on the weak and the vulnerable. They were asking more for women to be treated with equal dignity and respect. And everyone who is in a position of being weak or powerless deserves that right as well. I think you're really going to enjoy this talk. Stay with it. She has a number of beautiful things to say. And I'm so glad that the actual tape recording worked and we got the entire talk coming up here for you. And again, we'll bring you that talk just in a short bit. I wanted to also emphasize that this week is the Feast of the Presentation of Our Lord. It's also known as Candlemas. And why do we do that? Why do we have this procession at the back of the church in some parishes with candles and we process into the church with these lit candles? Kind of reminds us of something on the Easter Vigil. Well, it's on the same theme because on this day, Mary and Joseph brought Jesus into the church. They were presenting him to God the Father in the temple. And he represents what? He represents the light of the world. He is the light to all nations. So as Mary and Joseph process in with their son, the light of the world, Jesus Christ, the only begotten Son of the Father, they process him in as a light to the nations. And that's why we have the candles and the blessing of the candles. This should also evoke memories of our own baptism, right? Because when we were baptized, we were presented into the church formally and also given a candle to be reminded that we are also participants in Christ's mission as lights to the world. So that's why we celebrate the presentation of our Lord, Candlemas, the blessing of the candles. And then on Monday, one day right after this Sunday feast day, we have the Feast of St. Blaise, where we will take two candles and bless throats. So we have all these sort of smells and bells in the church this week. We're turning the calendar page. We're into February coming up this weekend. And it's also when we're going to sort of think about starting our Lenten observance, which happens later this month. Anyway, we have an exciting show coming up, but let's begin with prayer. This week we will proclaim, "Behold, the Lord will come with power to enlighten the eyes of his servants." And our prayer, "O God, true light, who created light eternal, spreading it far and wide, pour, we pray, into the hearts of the faithful the brilliance of perpetual light, so that all who are brightened in your holy temple by the splendor of these candles may happily reach the light of your glory. Through Christ our Lord. Amen." Well, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be back with Erica Bacciocci. And she's written this wonderful dissertation on the role of the early feminists in our country and how they were pro-life from the beginning. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Joining us right now is a talk. We're going to present a talk from the March for Life from Erica Bacciocci. This was not a talk given on the stage where there were thousands and millions of people. This was a small, intimate conference that was given during the March for Life, and I thought it was just a wonderful presentation and message that most women don't get to hear. So let's get started and bring you that right now.
These days, we are often led to believe that women's rights, women's liberty and equality, to use the current catchphrase, reproductive justice, is simply synonymous with easy access to abortion. Abortion rights are the sine qua non, we are told, of women's freedom and equality. And this is not just political rhetoric, it is legal strategy too. For leading pro-choice legal scholars now argue, without notable exception, that abortion rights are really equality rights, and so ought to be protected not by the right to privacy, as in Roe v. Wade, but by the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. According to the foremost ambassador of this approach, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, abortion rights are even necessary for women to enjoy equal citizenship stature. But here's the thing. When we mine the intellectual history of the cause of women's rights, we find that Ginsburg's vision of equal citizenship as inclusive of the right to abortion stands in sharp contrast to how earlier generations of women's rights advocates first championed this important philosophical and political principle. In fact, as I'll discuss this morning, the very rationale for women's rights, indeed for civil and political freedom and equality as such, has shifted profoundly since women secured the franchise in this country 100 years ago. But this shift has occurred subtly and over time, so that many now falsely assume that an unbroken line can be traced from those who today agitate for women's rights to those who argue that women have the right to do so in the first place. So this morning, leaning on great women from the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, I want to suggest instead that the constitutional right to abortion has hindered women's authentic liberty and equality. Rather than render women freer and more equal, the right to abortion has cheapened and objectified women, cheapened sex and objectified women, made it easier to ignore the asymmetries inherent in male-female sexual relationships, belittled the essential contributions of both mothers and fathers, and lent strongly to the dim view our culture has accorded the essential work of caregiving ever since. quite a task I've laid for myself, so I best get started. So let's begin with the philosophical foundations of the early women's rights movement in the United States. And to do so, let's turn to that late 18th century British philosopher and heroine of the American suffragists, author of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, Mary Wollstonecraft. For Wollstonecraft, civil and political rights for both men and women were essential to human dignity and political progress. But Wollstonecraft did not regard such rights as ends in themselves, to free men and women to live in whatever manner they might choose. No, civil and political rights were grounded in pre-existing duties to self, family, fellow citizens, and God. That is, civil and political freedom and equality were essential means to higher human ends, the moral development of persons, and the virtuous fulfillment of the ordinary duties of life. Wollstonecraft's appeal for women's co-equal education is her most remembered contribution today. Her rationale, perhaps less so. The self-taught philosopher believed that were women, like men, afforded both intellectual and moral education and opportunities to engage in serious-minded occupations, women would enjoy greater independence of mind and, in turn, better appreciate their duties to their families and the broader society as well. Intellectual and moral excellence, or to use her words, wisdom and virtue, represented for Wollstonecraft the very highest attainments of human life, for both men and women in equal measure. Now, the civil and political rights that Wollstonecraft first claimed for women in the late 18th century have been, over time and with great struggle, steadily secured in modern democracies around the world. But Wollstonecraft proposed in her Rights of Woman a far more substantive vision than what is often represented today as merely a political treatise in favor of women's rights in marriage, education, employment, and political participation. Her ennobling philosophical and moral vision, upon which she built her rights claims, has largely been abandoned. For Wollstonecraft, it was women's capacity to reason, and thus to pursue reason to its proper ends, again, wisdom and virtue, that provided the philosophical foundation for women's just claims to civil and political freedom and equality. But not just for women. Freedom as such was a necessary means to these higher human ends. It was the forgetfulness of these noble ends on the part of men, especially, that facilitated the subjugation and victimization of women, even in their own homes. A freedom bereft of wisdom and virtue would reduce men to beasts, Wollstonecraft claimed. And this was especially true in intimate relations between men and women, for she thought the two sexes mutually corrupt and improve each other. The late 18th century philosopher well understood with the ancients that personal and political freedom could only be realized by those who first knew how to govern themselves, especially their own desires. I do not wish for women to have power over men, but over themselves, she famously quipped. Following this logic closely, Wollstonecraft maintained that sexual integrity was not to be abandoned in the pursuit of the just advancement of women or the equality of the sexes, nor was the virtue of chastity, as she called it, especially required of women, as was the convention of her day. Rather, it was men who, in pursuing self-serving indulgence without habitual respect for women or for the noble purposes of sex and the goods of shared domestic life, had too often failed to treat women with the dignity they deserved. Women, for their part, had too often acquiesced, fashioning themselves, she complained, more pleasing to the eyes than strong in the mind. Indeed, alongside neglect for women's co-equal education, Wollstonecraft identified want of chastity in men as the single most consequential offense against women. Now, given the difficulty of achieving self-mastery and the high call of both mothers and fathers to impart it in their children while young, she believed the societal effects of this virtue in men in particular would be revolutionary. For, as Wollstonecraft saw it, when men lacked chastity, women were put in especially precarious situations. dominated by bodily lust rather than the virtuous master of it. A man's stronger physicality put the object of his desire directly in harm's way. And beyond the threat of physical harm, it was not him, but his victim, who might end up unwillingly pregnant as a result. She writes, "Sexual intemperance, so prevalent, depraves the appetite to such a degree that the parental design of nature is forgotten. And the mere person for that moment alone engrosses the thoughts." Wollstonecraft's most cogent moral aphorism rings especially true here. "Cherish such a habitual respect for mankind as that it may prevent us from disgusting a fellow creature for the sake of a present indulgence." Now, Wollstonecraft well knew that how women in her time sometimes turned to abortion to escape desperate situations. But she also knew that to destroy the embryo in the womb or cast it off when born, as she said, was not the answer. Indeed, Wollstonecraft blasts the idea that humanity had come so far from the barbarism of antiquity, at which time parents routinely abandoned the elements their infants were born, but unwanted. She demanded that in such situations, the father maintain both mother and child, so that he may not, quote, spurn the victims of his lawless appetites. An advocate of responsible fatherhood, she was. Of abortion, she was not. And this, we ought to remember, was at a time when embryonic development was far less understood and pregnancy far more hazardous to women than in her own time. In fact, complications following childbirth would take Wollstonecraft's own life when she bore, after she bore her second child, Mary Shelley, at the age of 38. It's unfortunate that over the last 60 years, when feminists have rightly celebrated Wollstonecraft's pioneering views about women in education, marriage, and the professions, they have not taken her insights about sex seriously. With the sex crimes that continue to beset women in our own time, those who today wield far more societal influence than women in the late 18th century did, we best pay her some serious attention. She wished not for sexual repression, but for growth in self-mastery, an achievement that was born, she believed, of mutual regard in men for women and in women for men. The original vindicator of the rights of woman thus proposed a radical vision of integrity for both sexes, with a view toward egalitarian relationships of reciprocity, trust, and collaboration. Her inspiring vision of civil and political freedom and equality for men and women was built upon the bedrock of such relationships, first forged, she believed, in the shared duties of care in the home. Thus it is that her still yet untried program poses an especially striking challenge to a modern day women's movement shaped since the 1970s by a very different kind of sexual revolution. 50 years after Wollstonecraft wrote, the early American women's rights movement would take its inspiration in large measure from her provocative and ennobling vision. They too believed that efforts to grant women rights to co-equal education, entry into the professions, and in time, the franchise, were essential to achieving true social and political equality between the sexes. But these women also understood, following Wollstonecraft, that it was in the sexual and marital relationship between men and women that authentic equality and harmonious companionship would ultimately be found or forsaken. For the 19th century women's rights advocates, as for Wollstonecraft before them, sexual integrity was the key precondition for authentic equality and collaboration between the sexes. At Seneca Falls in 1848, for instance, when the earliest women's rights advocates were demanding women's equal participation in all spheres of life, they sought also to call attention to the unjust sexual double standard that prevailed in their time. Among the many other resolutions of the historic Women's Rights Convention was this one, that the same amount of virtue, delicacy, and refinement of behavior that is required of woman be required of man. Notice that they sought not to reject the high standards to which women in society were called at that time, but rather demanded that men adhere to those standards as well. Votes for women, chastity for men was actually a suffragist slogan. And so out of respect for both the reproductive potential of sex and women's distinctive role in it. The 19th century women's rights movement advocated what they called voluntary motherhood, a precursor not to abortion or even to contraception, but to natural methods of fertility regulation, which have only grown more scientific and effective in our day. In fact, pro-choice historian Linda Gordon writes that upon no other question did 19th century women's rights advocates agree more universally than the concept of voluntary motherhood. From suffragists to moral reformers to small free love groups, all embraced the view that when pregnancy was not desired, permanent or periodic abstinence by mutual decision by the couple or a unilateral decision by the woman was the best means to both harmonize and equalize the asymmetrical sexual relationship between husband and wife and to instill moderating habits of self-mastery and intimate regard for the other. Men were to possess governance over their own desires and women sovereignty over their own bodies. The universal call for voluntary motherhood was also their response to the evil of abortion, an underground practice that was receiving greater scrutiny with the scientific advances in embryology. Condemned at that time across society, abortion and infanticide were referred to together as child murder in the pages of the women's rights newspaper, The Revolution. But unlike some leading male opponents of abortion, who at that time often blamed women for their fate, the women's rights advocates argued that women were often forced into the crime of abortion by the poor circumstances of their lives. Thus, like Wollstonecraft before them, 19th century women's rights advocates sought to call attention to the causes of abortion, laying the blame instead often at the feet of lustful men and women's unequal status in society. Indeed, among the most radical of the suffragists, Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote in The Revolution that the degradation of women was causing some to, here quoting another newspaper, murder their children either before or after birth. The remedy to this and other abuses, Stanton argued, was the education and enfranchisement of women. Articulating cogently the underlying rationale for voluntary motherhood was the first woman to run for president of the United States in 1872 on the Equal Rights Party ticket. With her peers in the 19th century women's movement, Victoria Woodhull argued, among other rights, the right to be free of the common law sexual prerogative that husbands then enjoy over their wives. While understanding the asymmetrical consequences of sexual intercourse, Woodhull looked to a time when woman rises from sexual slavery to sexual freedom, into the ownership and control of her sexual organs, and man is obliged to respect this freedom. Likewise, Cady Stanton would write similarly that the right to control one's body was a preeminent personal and political right, and she sought to convince other women to educate our daughters to regard their lives and bodies and the laws which govern them. But owning and controlling one's body did not extend for these 19th century women to doing what one willed with the body of another, one's unborn child growing thin. Indeed, the leaders of the women's movement sought sovereignty over their own bodies and the knowledge of the laws that governed them, in part because they knew they had no legitimate authority to dispose of their unborn children's very lives.
We're going to interrupt this talk and take a quick break for a station identification, and we'll be right back. And we'll be back right after the station identification. You are listening to Holy Spirit Radio, 1570 AM in Doylestown and 1420 AM in Coatesville and Chester County.
We would understand. You are the rock of salvation, the only foundation.
Welcome back. Right now, you're listening to a talk by Erica Bacciocci. She's with the Ethics and Public Policy Center speaking on the topic of pro-life is pro-women. This was a talk given prior to the March for Life, and we'll take you right back to that talk.
An early and outspoken advocate of constitutional equality for women Woodhull also championed the rights of children, rights which he argued begin while they yet remain the fetus. In 1870, she wrote, again, the first woman to run for president, "Many women who would be shocked at the very thought of killing their children after birth deliberately destroy them previously. If there's any difference in the actual crime, we should be glad to have those who practice the latter pointed out. The truth of the matter is that it is just as much a murder to destroy life in its embryonic condition as it is to destroy it after the fully developed form is attained. For it is the self-same life that is taken." Notably, these strong anti-abortion sentiments of the first woman to run for president coincided not only with the advances in embryology that had inspired the 19th century passage of state laws prohibiting most abortions at or near fertilization, in many cases, the very laws that Roe v. Wade struck down. Woodhull's remarks also coincided with the ratification of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution in 1868, the one that prohibits the deprivation of every person's right to life and liberty without due process of law and ensures the equal protection of those laws. It is deeply ironic, then, that it is this same constitutional text that today's feminists insist protects the right to destroy that self-same life in its embryonic condition, or in these days, just up until birth and funded by our taxes, too. Now, to be sure, feminists today do appeal rhetorically to the 19th century women's rights advocates' poor belief that, in Stanton's words, the right to control one's body was the preeminent personal and political right. But crucially, modern-day feminists who use this language to advocate for abortion rights have turned the revolutionary appeal for voluntary motherhood squarely on its head. For no longer does the right of voluntary or chosen motherhood mean affirmatively choosing when to engage in that act that might make one a mother. Now it means affirmatively choosing whether to end the life of one's nascent child developing within. The original principle sought to protect against this revolting fate. The 1970s transmutation seized right onto it. For Wollstonecraft, we should recall, authentic rights were grounded in prior duties. It would be philosophically untenable to claim that a mother could enjoy a right to end the life of her own child. Rather, she enjoyed rights to better discharge her special duties of care she owed to that child. And such maternal duties for Wollstonecraft imply paternal duties too. Thus, Wollstonecraft's central belief that women's rights depended upon men taking up their responsibilities both to women and to the children under their mutual care. More still, if the mother or father lacked the capacity to care for their child for want of some right or privilege, the fault lay with the society in which they lived. Nearly a century after Wollstonecraft wrote her courageous treatise, writer and suffragist Maddie Brinkerhoff would articulate a similar sentiment in the revolution in 1869, one that I'm sure many of you have heard before. When a man steals to satisfy hunger, When a man steals to satisfy hunger, we may safely conclude that something is wrong in society. So when a woman destroys the life of her unborn child, it is an evidence that by education or circumstances, she has been greatly wronged. After all, like Wollstonecraft, her 19th century successors were not oblivious to the fact that pregnancy was not always welcome in the life of a woman, even for those who practiced this scientifically rudimentary form of voluntary motherhood. Yet such trying circumstances did not transform an unwelcome pregnancy into one that was forced or compulsory, in the words of abortion advocates today. Forced motherhood in the 19th century view would have been the result of forced or unwanted sex, not the presence of the nascent child who was rightfully due care, whatever the circumstances of her conception. Rather, the fact that sexual intercourse has the potential to create a new, independent human being, a being who developed in the body of a woman, meant that women should enjoy the right to demand that men who wielded far more power over women, physically, culturally, and at that time legally too, govern their sexual appetites so that the unique and at that time uniquely dangerous state of motherhood would be undertaken voluntarily. In the words of Woodhull's sister, Tennessee Claflin, who with Woodhull opened the first woman-run Wall Street brokerage firm, no woman should ever hold sexual relations with any man from the possible consequences of which he might desire to escape. This was not a condemnation of women, but a call to arms against male sexual presumption. These earlier women's rights advocates thus understood a reality that goes unacknowledged by most feminists today, even after the harrowing stories of the Me Too movement. If powerful, sexually aggressive men already tend toward sexual presumption, that presumption grows stronger still when the costs of sex are greatly reduced by easy access to abortion. Indeed, radical feminist Catherine MacKinnon was closer to the older view when in 1983 she wrote, "So long as women do not control access to our sexuality, abortion facilitates women's heterosexual availability and frees male sexual aggression." In the privacy of bedrooms, MacKinnon argues, consent tends to be presumed. But even MacKinnon makes one rather startling historical error. In the very same essay, she frets, "In this context of male sexual presumption, it becomes clear why the struggle for reproductive freedom has never included a woman's right to refuse sex. Sexual liberation," she suggests, "has always been framed as a struggle for women to have sex with men on the same terms as men, without consequences. Yet the right to refuse sex is precisely the right and freedom the 19th century advocates of voluntary motherhood sought." For the early women's rights advocates, abortion not only took the life of an unborn child, an act of violence they deplored, abortion also tilted the sexual playing field further in the male direction, empowering men to prioritize sexual intercourse and their own sexual satisfaction and to ignore the asymmetrical consequences of the sexual act. In light of these inequalities in sex and desire and satisfaction and reproduction and in caregiving too, the voluntary motherhood movement thus expected men to conform themselves to women's sexual needs and desires rather than to their own. This movement, we ought to remember, was one championed not only by the women's advocates themselves, but by men who joined the noble cause too. And yet their insights were abandoned the very next century, just at that point in history when women were gaining the kind of influence in both the private and public spheres that could have made the expectation of male sexual integrity culturally normative. That women a century later, who now wield the power of the vote and more rights and privileges still, would find it necessary to advocate for abortion reveals perhaps that the women's movement has not made the advances their predecessors thought they would. Or perhaps the women's movement made a wrong turn along the way. And so we come to the early 1970s. When women's rights advocates began to offer equality arguments now in favor of abortion rights, they also revealed just how much further the women's rights movement still had to go to gain cultural and legal respect for women's contributions, both at home, in the home and in the workplace. These advocates properly called attention to the reproductive and social asymmetries between men and women, inequalities in which to which women's rights advocates had always sought to respond. But whereas prior generations regarded abortion as evidence that a woman had been greatly wronged by both a particular man and society at large, the 1970s feminists now regarded legal abortion as a means to right those wrongs. Consider, for instance, a 1969 case challenging New York State's then relatively restrictive abortion law. In the first of its kind legal brief, the attorneys argued that since the burdens of carrying and bearing children were borne exclusively by women, even though both men and women had, quote, equal responsibility for the act of sexual intercourse, legal abortion would be necessary to equalize the sexes. Since the brief states, quote, "The man who shares responsibility for her pregnancy can and often just walk away," legal abortion, legal equality demanded that women ought to enjoy that same freedom through abortion. As Harvard Law professor Lawrence Tribe would articulate the concept two decades later, while men retain the right to sexual and reproductive autonomy, restrictions on abortion deny that autonomy to women. But let's be very clear about this. It is not abortion restrictions that deny sexual and reproductive autonomy to women. The state of pregnancy itself exhibits the embodied reality that when pregnant, a woman is not physically autonomous. She is carrying a new, albeit dependent and vulnerable human being within her. Thus, unlike a man who has fathered a child, a pregnant woman cannot just walk away. To approach the desired autonomy of the child-abandoning man, a pregnant woman must engage in a life-destroying act. Sexual equality, then, in this altogether new view, was found not by demanding that men be required to meet women a high standard of mutual care and responsibility, as Wollstonecraft and the 19th century women's rights advocates had argued. Rather, as men had wielded the common law right of dominion over their wives, women would now seek a similar right to the ultimate sort of dominion over their unborn children. It was indeed a peculiar breed of women's rights advocacy that would seek to rely on the subordination of and violence against another class of human beings, vulnerable children no less, in its efforts to elevate women. In a 1995 essay reporting on the origins of that still great organization, Feminists for Life, pro-life feminist Sydney Osborne articulates nicely this parallel between the historic treatment of women and the new arguments for legal abortion. Having known oppression, we cannot stand by and allow the oppression of an entire class of weaker human beings. Having once been owned by our husbands, we cannot condone a position that says the unborn are owned by their mothers. Remembering a time when our values were determined by whether a man wanted us, we refuse to bow to the patriarchal attitude that says the unborn child's value is determined by whether a woman wants her. Earlier women's rights advocates had fought for the political means to work toward a society more hospitable to women and their vulnerable children, both born and unborn too. The attorneys in the 1969 New York case rightly described the many ways in which modern day society was still inhospitable to women and children 50 years on from women's suffrage. Society had clearly failed women, not only because women were putting their lives and health at risk when they sought out then illegal abortions. If they carried their children to term, the brief argued, the status of motherhood itself, especially unwed motherhood, subjected women to a whole range of de facto types of discrimination. The brief offered an abundance of examples of very real discrimination against pregnant women and working mothers. Young women might be expelled from school or robbed of the opportunity for education. They could be fired from employment, denied a job, or forced to live on welfare. Women were also solely responsible for the child's expenses while in utero and for the next 18 years. And should that child become a juvenile delinquent, women were regarded as responsible for that too. In a word, children were still unjustly regarded as women's sole responsibility. And so, in a fateful leap in logic, the attorneys then claimed the child's very existence became her mother's choice. The historic brief concludes its section on equality with the following legal claim, one that has since become the single most popular legal argument for abortion rights, even though the 1979 decision in Roe rendered this particular case moot. As long as she is forced to bear such extraordinarily disproportionate share of the pains and burdens of childbearing, including, of course, pregnancy and childbirth, then to deprive her of the ultimate choice as to whether she will in fact bear those burdens violates the most basic aspects of our American idea of fairness, guaranteed and enshrined in the 14th Amendment. Or as Justice Ginsburg put it more succinctly, abortion rights are necessary for women's equal citizenship. Here's Justice Ginsburg again. A woman's autonomous charge of her full life's course, her ability to stand in relation to man, society, and the state as an independent, self-sustaining, equal citizen is at stake, she says, in the abortion question. But abortion advocates like Ginsburg and these other feminist attorneys seem not to recognize that abortion, as a response to the failures of men and society, leaves the burden for children and the management of fertility squarely on the shoulders, or better, the bodies of women, just as they always have been. Abortion further alleviates men of their shared duties of care. Rather than make significant demands upon men in society as prior generations of women's rights advocates have, this new view champions the autonomous, child-abandoning male, or the one with no caregiving responsibilities, as the very model for equal citizenship. Women are only full citizens, able to stand in relation to man, society, and the state, we are told, if they but become autonomous and self-sustaining, that is, leave their children behind. And yet, this view of equal citizenship, one that requires an unmitigated right to abortion, would seem to be in some tension with the very definition of full citizenship Ginsburg herself offered in an opinion for the court in a famous 1996 sex discrimination case. In VMI, Ginsburg wrote, "Full citizenship is defined by those who have the equal opportunity to aspire, achieve, participate in, and contribute to society based on their individual talents and capacities." But men and women are not free-floating, autonomous minds. We are embodied individuals who enjoy distinctive capacities when it comes to sex and reproduction. If citizenship is understood along the traditional male model, one that assumes the capacity to remain physically autonomous from the reproductive consequences of sexual intercourse and unencumbered by the demands of caregiving, the affirmative attachment and nurturing required of young children and those who care for them become symbols of dependence, anathema in this view of citizenship. Those whose autonomy is constrained by their caregiving responsibilities are defined on the outside of citizenship, just as they traditionally have been. Indeed, Justice Ginsburg seems to underappreciate how her praise of autonomy as the defining characteristic of citizenship undervalues those with caregiving responsibilities, especially when those responsibilities impede one's capacity to work like an autonomous, unencumbered man. The bias then is set against those who seek to work fewer or more flexible hours when they have children, take months or even years away from the workplace with the hope of re-engaging when their caregiving duties subside, or due to their commitments in their homes or communities, choose not to enter the paid workforce at all. Given the popularity of Ginsburg's view in the feminist movement today, it is no surprise that work-family balance remains such a pressing issue. And it is women's status as mothers, not their status as women, that causes the greatest inequities socially and professionally, even as women have made remarkable gains overall. If the so-called gender revolution has stalled, elevating women in the workplace without simultaneously elevating and honoring the work both mothers and fathers do in the home, then constitutionalizing the right to abortion shares a good deal of the blame. For without Roe v. Wade, but with Ginsburg's own commendable wins in sex discrimination cases in the 1970s and the pregnancy discrimination cases that followed, workplaces would have had to adjust much more quickly to encumbered women and duly encumbered men, and so to the demands of the child-rearing family more generally. But instead, relatively easy access to abortion in the U.S. over the last several decades has made it unnecessary for businesses and other institutions to make room for this most essential cultural reality. Most working persons are, or ought to be, deeply encumbered by their prior obligations to their families and the dependent and vulnerable at large. So now, in the time I have left with you, I want to begin to propose a reproductive justice of a more authentic kind. For the question for a society that really cares about treating both men and women with justice and equal dignity and supporting and encouraging the good use of all their talents is how we respond personally and culturally to the fact of sexual asymmetry, the ever-apparent reproductive differences in the male and female bodies that are not going away. Of course, the most obvious and relevant asymmetrical difference is the extensive time and laborious exertion mothers undertake in pregnancy, and for those who pursue it, breastfeeding. This 9+ month embodied exertion is often rendered colloquially as a burden, or as comparatively akin in anti-discrimination law to male disability. And it is true for most women, pregnancy is accompanied by serious sustained discomfort and fatigue, and for some, more serious conditions still. Yet the wondrous capacity to bear another human being in one's body and to suckle that child at one's breast too often goes unspoken today, as though to call attention to it would be to treat women as mere instruments, forgetting the subject who possesses this incredible privilege, or devaluing those who do not undertake it. Indeed, contrary to bygone notions of earlier times, women's reproductive capacity does not impose upon each woman a general duty to bear children, nor does bearing children mean that women are unable to do anything but, as though reproductive activities and intellectual and professional ones are mutually exclusive. This is the egregious mistake rightly corrected by anti-discrimination law today. Pregnant women or those who are otherwise caring for children must not be assumed to be less competent or committed to their professional work than their peers. But in shoring up respect for women as rational individuals and agents in their own lives, we best not make the contrary error. It's not sexist, or in legal parlance, sex stereotyping, to recognize the life-giving power women uniquely possess, nor to notice that sexual intercourse has the potential to transform intimate or casual sexual partners into a biological mother and father. Given the stubborn sexual asymmetries that persist despite decades of widely available contraception and abortion, it would be sexist were we not to take due notice. Opening our eyes to the realities of sex for women, an intimate and embodied source of connectivity, and so not just for sport, also helps us to see better the reality of pregnancy, the most intimate, embodied experience of connection, nurturance, and solidarity that human beings are capable of, and one that is enjoyed by women alone. If pregnancy is likened, as it often is in our culture, to any other lifestyle choice or medical condition, or worse, a disability in a Hobbesian survival of the fittest against wombless men, pregnant women will never receive the cultural esteem and support they, in justice, are due. Rather, it is only by reestablishing the inherent value and equality of each human being, that moral proposition to which our country has ever been called, will pregnant women and caregiving families receive the public support and commendation they, in justice, deserve. For the cultural value of our caregiving depends unavoidably upon the cultural value we give the vulnerable and dependent human beings in our care. Indeed, as Wollstonecraft well understood, civil and political rights flow from pre-existing duties. Vulnerable children have a right in justice to that which is due them. Parents, likewise, enjoy the right to carry out their duties to their children. Good societies, order to the full flourishing of human beings, properly recognize and protect both. Thus, an authentic reproductive justice would not only ask expectant mothers to offer their developing unborn child care that is due them, for pregnant women and childbearing mothers to receive in justice the abundant care and support they need, fathers must take up their shared duties of care toward both mother and child as well. For as the deeply prescient author of the original treatise on women's rights saw very clearly, the single best response to the sexual asymmetries in both human reproduction and in caregiving too is an emotionally engaged and deeply attentive fatherhood. Such a fatherhood is most essentially one in which men who sire children recognize the distinctive and irreplaceable bonds they enjoy with them. But even more than that, it is the embrace of fatherhood as a core, constitutive, primary identity for men with children, one which prioritizes the collaborative, character-shaping, solidarity-building work of the home, and deeply respects the distinctive burdens and privileges women experience in childbearing and rearing, just as good men in generations past and present have always done. As Mary Wollstonecraft anticipated more than two centuries ago, the very well-being of women and children depends upon the capacity of men to take up their responsibilities to both, a responsibility that extends backward to learning to live lives of sexual integrity from their youth. As early 20th century women's rights advocate Charlotte Perkins Gilman observed, chastity is a virtue because it promotes the human welfare. The underlying reason for the whole thing is the benefit of the child. And to that end, a pure and noble fatherhood is requisite, as well as such a motherhood. I cannot repeat enough that sexual integrity for both Wollstonecraft and her 19th and early 20th century successors was at the very core of their ennobling vision of freedom, equality, and happiness between men and women in the private sphere, the public, and beyond. But for authentic reproductive justice to prevail in our time, more than that is needed still. It is high time that the work of the family be given the cultural and political respect, attention, and support it deserves. An authentic reproductive justice would thus promote, once again, the historic view that our shared duties of care properly underlie our civil and political rights and privileges, and thereby provide the preconditions for our economic, political, and civil life together. And so let me conclude my remarks this morning by saying this. To be authentically pro-woman, one must be thoroughly pro-life. For the rights of women and men are grounded not in our mythical autonomy from one another, or worse still, our ghastly capacity to dominate the weak. Rather, our rights are on their surest foundation as the means to fulfill the common duties of life. And caring well for the weakest and most vulnerable among us surely ranks among the most supreme of all our shared responsibilities. It is thus with great enthusiasm that I send you forth to the March for Life this year. Celebrate women's equality in 2020 and beyond, but do it boldly, by forging together a society whose laws truly respect the equal dignity of each man, woman, and child, and whose policies support the familial and cultural goods that each of us needs to flourish. Thank you.
I see the world your way, and I'm not afraid to follow. I see the world your way, and I'm not ashamed to say so. I see the Jesus way, and I'm walking in the light.